Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague John Robbins in welcoming our guest, Dr. Neil Barnard. Clinical researcher and author Dr. Neil Barnard is one of America's leading advocates for health, nutrition, and higher standards in medical research. He's the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and he's an adjunct associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. Dr. Barnard has authored dozens of scientific publications as well as 15 books, including the New York Times bestseller, 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart. His latest blockbuster, Power Foods for the Brain, reveals how simple diet changes can shield the brain from memory loss, stroke, and Alzheimer's. So now, Neil, my dad and I are so excited to have this time with you. And here to interview you and welcome you onto this call is my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean. And, Neil, I join Ocean and all of our listeners in welcoming you and thanking you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, it's delightful to be with you. I appreciate everything you're doing, and thank you for inviting me to be part of the call.
In your latest book, Power Foods for the Brain, you describe a very considerable family history that you have with Alzheimer's. This is clearly personal for you. As it is for me, by the way, my mother died not that long ago of Alzheimer's, and her last years were extremely difficult. You describe recent research that suggests that food and lifestyle choices can help protect people whatever genetic hand they've been dealt. Can you tell our listeners something about your family background and its relationship to the disease, and what it is that people like you and me who may have a genetic predisposition towards Alzheimer's need to know?
Yeah, I'll tell you, when I was a kid and my mother's father started to get demented, he was a small-town doctor. He was a very sharp guy, but his memory started to go, and he was not old. He was about 60, early 60s. And he became confused, started wandering around the neighborhood, and died in his mid-60s. And in my little boy brain, I thought that's old age. I didn't attribute it to anything more than that. Now, his wife, my grandma, lived longer, but for the last maybe 10 years of her life, she lost her memory. And it started out, she was well aware of what was going on. She would say, I'm reading a magazine, and when I get to the end of an article, I can't remember the beginning anymore. It was really frustrating for her. But it got worse and worse, and for the last, maybe as much as 10 years, she didn't know anybody, and people would go visit her. She didn't know her children, her grandchildren. And the same thing happened to both of my father's parents and then my father. He diagnosed himself. He knew what was going on, and it was the most tragic thing. And when he died, which was a year ago, it was as if he had died many years earlier because everything that ever mattered to him had been ripped away. Okay, so that's the terrible news. Well, the even worse news is that about half of Americans get this disease by age 85. It's going to go way, way up due to the fact that baby boomers are now reaching older age, plus the fast food revolution escorted really bad foods into our diet in a way that was beyond anything we'd done before. So the good news is that we now know what parts of the diet seem to increase the risk, and in the same way that you can protect the heart, I believe you can protect the brain. So hopefully in our time together today, we can get into some of the specifics about the food changes that can make this not happen.
We will, and I just want to underline what I think we've just heard is that all four of your grandparents had Alzheimer's.
That's right.
And, you know, as you mentioned, this is, while you may have more of it in your family than some, the toll taken by Alzheimer's on the elderly is increasing so much today that the average 21st century American will likely spend more years caring for parents than they did for children. And the financial...
What a thought, yes.
Yeah, and the financial costs are just staggering. The disease already costs the Medicare system three times as much as any other disease. The tragic reality is that Alzheimer's has become so common in the industrialized world today among the elderly that many people have come to view it as an inevitable adjunct of aging. It's just what happens as you get old.
Right.
But I hear you saying that as widespread as Alzheimer's is, it is not inevitable.
we had that approach to heart disease. A couple of generations ago, heart disease was part of old age. And we defined old age in ways that make me blanch now. When you were in your 50s, you should have a heart attack, or you were expected to have a heart attack. And number one, 50s is not old age. Number two, heart disease is not part of aging. Heart disease is a disease. And we now know what causes it. We know what the risk factors are. We know how to prevent it. We know how to reverse it. Using a similar research effort in large populations of people, researchers, this started in Chicago, there's a similar group in New York, and there are a couple of groups in Europe that have tracked large groups of people. They've separated out which dietary patterns are linked to Alzheimer's disease and certain other forms of dementia. And we couldn't have said this 15 years ago because the research had not matured, but it has now. So we can take a lesson and we can rethink what we're going to have for breakfast.
We have new imaging techniques now that allow scientists to study the brain as a living system, to see how it functions and how it's affected over time by nutrition and lifestyle. And it's becoming increasingly clear that specific foods, specific eating behaviors, specific lifestyle and environmental factors have an enormous effect on the health of the brain as it ages. In your book, you speak of building a shield for your brain and the importance of protecting it from toxic metals in particular. Yet some of these very same metals that you're talking about are found actually in most multivitamins and are thought of commonly as important nutrients. So what's going on here?
Yeah, that's right. And there's maybe two big areas to touch on. The first is the fats and the second is the metals. In Chicago, the Chicago Health and Aging Project, 1993 they got started. They didn't ask people to change anything. All they did was track what people ate. And 10 years later, 2003, they issued a stunning finding. They showed those people who were eating the least amount of saturated fat, that's, as you know, the fat that's in dairy products and in meats particularly, bacon fat, chicken fat, cheese fat, ice cream fat, that saturated fat, the people who ate the least of that, and the people who ate the least trans fats, which are in some fried foods and snack foods like donuts, the people who avoided both of those, their risk of Alzheimer's was cut by as much as 70 or 80%. Just a huge change. People who tended to have low healthy cholesterol levels had a dramatically lower risk too. So there was something about avoiding the bad fats. But then the second thing was the people who tended to avoid certain metals. You need a trace of iron for healthy blood cells. You need a trace of copper for enzymes. But people who tended to get just the amount they needed with no excess tended to have protection also. Then where this all comes together is when you look in the brain of a person who has had Alzheimer's disease through these scanning techniques that you mentioned or at autopsy, you discover that in the brain are what are called amyloid plaques. They look like microscopic little specks. If you look at them under a microscope, they almost look like little meatballs, little balls of yarn. And what they're made up of are proteins, amyloid proteins that come out of the brain cells, and apparently the higher your cholesterol level from eating these bad fats, the more of this protein your brain cells makes. And then also in these plaques, these little meatballs, are little traces of iron, of copper, of aluminum. And so if we put all this together, we know which foods, which cookware, which other things in our lives bring us these potentially toxic metals. We know how to reduce our exposure. We know which foods bring us the bad fats. We know how to change that. And there are many other things that we can do that hopefully we'll talk about. But those two steps alone, minimizing the metal exposure, minimizing the fat exposure, those two would have the same kind of effect, I believe, on Alzheimer's disease as avoiding meats and avoiding smoking and things would have on heart disease. You see the bus bearing down on you, you can jump to the curb. And I believe that by making these changes, we can stop that assault of Alzheimer's disease.
So the important thing is to minimize the exposure to the toxic metals and at the same time reduce consumption of the bad fats, the saturated fats, the trans fats. What is it about those fats, which I would imagine also include partially hydrogenated oil?
Yes.
What about these fats that causes the damage?
There are two lines of inquiry here. The first is, you eat bad fats, you have a higher cholesterol level. And in turn, the high cholesterol level seems to make these beta amyloid proteins be produced in higher quantity and aggregate in the brain. And there's substantial evidence of that. There was an amazing study that was done by researchers with Kaiser Permanente. They measured cholesterol levels, and they found that if you had a higher cholesterol level, you had a much higher risk of Alzheimer's. If you had a low cholesterol, you had a lower risk. But what was amazing about this study was that they assessed the Alzheimer's disease when people were in their 70s and 80s and beyond. The cholesterol levels that predicted it were cholesterol levels when people were 40. In other words, what people were eating and what was pushing their cholesterol up was actually when they were relatively young people in the prime of life, and that predicted their risk later on. So the first thought is it must be the high cholesterol that's doing it. You eat bad fat, you have a higher cholesterol, that increases risk. Probably true. But the other possibility is that there's something about just the fat themselves, even if your cholesterol level doesn't rise very much. And that's quite likely. But the good news is the mechanism is less important than the action step. You know, I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota. We ate meat all the time. My extended family raised cattle. I made the decision to get away from that. I don't know if I'm going to prevent Alzheimer's disease in myself or in my brothers or my sister, but I'm sure going to try. Step one is to get the animal products off your plate. So that's what we have done. If there's no cheese on my plate, if the beef and the chicken and so forth are gone, then I'm really not eating the bad fat. And if I avoid the donuts and the other foods fried in the partially hydrogenated oils that you were mentioning, then I have stepped away from these major, major risk factors.
There was a study that found that people who ate meat as their main source of protein were nearly three times as likely to develop dementia as their vegetarian counterparts. A subsequent survey of the medical literature on diet and Alzheimer's was actually titled, Losing Your Mind for the Sake of a Burger. We've known for a long time now that there's a very strong correlation between meat consumption and heart disease, and between meat consumption and colon cancer, and between meat consumption and premature death. How strong is the correlation between meat consumption and Alzheimer's disease?
I think it's very strong. Now, the science is never perfect on this, so we're always going based on the best available evidence. But I think the evidence is now, and has for some years, been strong enough that it is a serious mistake not to take action. There was an interesting study also done at Loma Linda University, where they brought in a group of people, generally health conscious, but some were meat eaters and some were vegetarians, some were vegan. They paired them up in groups of four, one vegan, one ovo-lacto vegetarian, a person who's not eating meat, but they're eating dairy products and eggs, and two meat eaters. And they just tracked over time to see who would lapse into dementia. And the vegetarians and vegans held out much, much longer. They were much less likely to succumb to dementia. And in the same way, they're less likely to succumb to a heart attack or these other things. So I think the evidence is strong enough now, but it's not only meat. Meat is one source. And by the way, I'm including chicken in this group too, because chicken has quite a fair amount of saturated fat, and even fish. You can make a case that people who eat fish do somewhat better, and as a group they do, but about 70 to 85% of the fat in fish is not the beneficial omega-3s. Between 70 and 85% is either the bad fat or certain kinds of unnecessary fat. So it's nothing like broccoli and beans and rice and so forth. The worst of the lot is dairy. If you look at kids today and you think, where are they getting that saturated fat that's going to give them problems in later life? Dairy products are the biggest source, whether it's the cheese on the pizza or the glass of milk that their well-meaning parents put in front of them, or yogurt, or any of the other dairy products that are so ubiquitous nowadays.
I don't know what exactly the mechanism is, but I did see a study very recently in the Annals of Neurology by a group of Harvard researchers. You may be familiar with it. They found that women consuming the most saturated fat were far more likely to develop dementia than those consuming the least.
Yes, that's right. And then contrary-wise, these same studies have started to then shift their focus onto, are there any foods that are protective? So, for example, if I have some walnuts or pecans or almonds, their bad fat content is quite low, but their content of vitamin E is really very high. And so the same Chicago study that was pointing a finger at bad fat looked at the vitamin E-rich foods, and they showed that they could reduce the risk of Alzheimer's by anywhere between 25 and as much as 70%. So that means walnuts, pecans, almonds, sunflower seeds, sesame seeds. And you just crumble up a little bit of walnuts and put them on your salad, maybe an ounce, small, tiny little handful. I think that would make a big difference. Green leafy vegetables, which are rich in folate. By the way, I often remind people, foliage is where the name folate comes from. So if you eat green leafy vegetables, foliage, in other words, you're going to get this protective B vitamin that's good for your brain. Beans and bananas have vitamin B6, and there is vitamin B12, which is also important for the brain, and that really ought to come from a supplement because it's much more absorbable. The fact that's just about the one food that where the supplements are much more absorbable. But you put those three together, folate, B6, B12, they greatly reduce the risk of memory problems, and they do it by reducing a compound that forms in the brain called homocysteine. And homocysteine is like factory waste. As it is produced by cells, it needs to be eliminated, and for some people it builds up. And the way to shovel it out of your brain is to get these three B vitamins, folate, B6, and B12. So part of the message is things to avoid. The other part of the message is the things that we want to emphasize in our diets.
And those are, I'm hearing, diets high in antioxidants, and in particular B vitamins, which enable the body to get rid of the excess homocysteine from the blood.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Plus the vitamin E, which is an antioxidant in a separate class. Oh, and by the way, you can go to the store and buy vitamin E. But the manufacturer only puts in usually one form, sometimes two, of the vitamin E in the pills. But when nature conceived of a walnut, it included all the natural forms of vitamin E. They're all biologically active. So the research is much more favorable toward the food sources of vitamin E than the pill sources. And let me also cheerlead for grapes and berries. As you know, researchers have said there's a little bit of a benefit to red wine. And researchers in France, big wine region of the world, have shown that when people drink a little red wine every day, their risk of Alzheimer's plummets. However, researchers have said there's a downside of wine as well. It can increase the risk of breast cancer, and if it's more than a couple of glasses a day, it increases the risk of just many, many problems. So researchers said maybe it's not the wine. Maybe it's not the alcohol. Maybe it's the grape. The dark coloring in a grape is called anthocyanins. That's a powerful antioxidant. And at the University of Cincinnati, they showed that when older folks who had memory problems increased their intake of anthocyanins, their memories gradually improved. It took about 12 weeks to see a difference, but there was a difference. And they showed it first with grapes, and they showed it second with blueberries. And they did it with juice, about 2 cups of juice per day. But my message is, what if I have some blueberries on my pancakes in the morning or on my oatmeal? And then later in the day, I might have some grapes on my salad. You just incorporate these brightly colored foods in your routine, and you get a whole range of the antioxidants that our bodies are designed for. So I think it's a really good way to go.
Are the antioxidants and nutrients you're talking about in grapes found in raisins?
Yes. Yeah, they are. It's that dark coloring.
Well, you know, one of the things that comes to mind as I listen to you is that most of us grew up with the idea that meat is a good source of iron, and that iron is really important. I remember Geritol commercials speaking about people suffering from iron poor blood, and it's clear that meat is, and beef in particular, is a very good source of iron, maybe too good a source. There is a difference, I know, between the type of iron found in beef compared to the type found in green leafy vegetables, and that difference may be very significant here. It's been generally seen as an advantage for the type of iron found in beef, but if we're getting too much, it actually may be an advantage for the type found in green leafy vegetables. Can you talk about this?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, and the evidence has been building on this for quite some time. There was a book came out called Iron Balance. It was written by a Harvard researcher, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, and I don't think very many people read this, unfortunately, but the point he made was that you need a little iron for healthy blood cells, but if you get too much iron, it's bad for the heart, it's bad for the brain, it's bad in many ways. Well, what does this mean for food? If you eat green leafy vegetables or beans or any other plant food, the iron that is contained in plants is called non-heme iron. If you're low in iron, if you're a little bit anemic, that iron in these plants is much more absorbable. If you are high in iron, you've been eating too much of it, or you've got plenty on board already, that form of iron is different. It's less absorbable in that case. In other words, your body's absorption of it varies depending on whether you have a little or a lot. Now, the iron that's in red meat, much of it is called heme iron, and it pretty much just barges into your party whether you need it or not. In other words, you might have too much iron already. You might already be overdosing, but then that steak or roast beef adds more and more and more iron to the system. Now, women prior to the age of menopause, because there is a certain amount of iron loss every month with menstruation, they tend to not run into much of a problem. Once menopause hits, then they start accumulating iron, and for men, throughout their whole lives, they're accumulating iron as well. If we were to use green vegetables and beans as our source of iron, the risk of iron overdose would plummet. Unfortunately, meat is popular, and it has this negative effect. It's not just the fat and the cholesterol, but the iron as well.
Well, there are many multivitamins that contain iron, and women in their reproductive years are often encouraged to take iron supplement or multivitamins that contain it. It seems as though the fact that iron is a prooxidant, not an antioxidant, that the fact that iron overloads are actually correlated to a lot of problems in the body and mind. It seems like we have to really rethink our relationship to iron and cast iron pots as well, I imagine.
Yeah, we do. Again, you need a trace of it, but we're overdosing all the time. And I think that the supplementation of iron is laziness. The doctor says, okay, you're pregnant, maybe you should be taking iron. What the doctor ought to do is say, let's test your iron level. And if it's adequate already, then they should not be hitting you up with more. If you're anemic, then by all means, let's bring in the green leafy vegetables and beans. Let's start there. By the way, this is another reason to avoid dairy, because dairy inhibits iron absorption. So when you see people who are anemic, it's not that they're not eating iron. It's usually because they're eating some inhibitor, and dairy is one of them. So I think we shouldn't be automatically supplementing with these things. And where I'm particularly worried is multiple vitamins. While the vitamins they contain are terrific, the vitamin B12 they have, that's good. The vitamin D is often very useful. But when they're adding minerals, they're adding metals, iron and also copper and zinc, they're giving you a dose of these that you don't need because you're getting it in foods. In the Chicago study I was describing, they looked at people who had a high intake of bad fat, saturated fat. And then they looked at those who also had a high intake of copper. And those who had the most copper intake and the most saturated fat, it was the equivalent of 19 extra years of aging in the effect on the brain. So if you can imagine a 50-year-old responding more like they were 69 years of age, you know, this is not something you want.
I want to highlight that. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that the Chicago Health and Aging Project found that people who were in the highest levels with their saturated fat intake and also had the most copper, their brains aged 19 years beyond the aging of people in the lower levels of those?
That's exactly right. Needless to say, none of them was thinking about this, and the amount of added copper is minuscule. To give you the numbers, the amount of copper that you need, the recommended daily allowance, is not quite 1 milligram, just under 1 milligram. The toxic amount in that study was just under 3 milligrams. To put this in perspective, a penny weighs 2,500 milligrams. So the most people are on the knife edge of getting an adequate amount or getting too much. And the copper comes from liver, shellfish, lobster, crab, shrimp, for example, or as well as copper pipes and the multiple vitamins. Vitamins vary a lot, but most all of them have added copper unless you go to the store, and there are a few brands that are marked vitamins only. Perfectly good choice. But the ones that have the added copper, the added iron, they're doing it as a marketing tool, making the assumption that you're not eating foods that have copper in them. But there are traces of copper in foods naturally. You should not be getting any extra.
Well, it sounds like the margin, the tolerance, is very, very small on copper, because we know that too much damages the brain, and we know that too little creates its own problems, including loss of synaptic transmission between brain cells. So it's a fine line. Now, I'm aware of some research that suggests that taking 1,000 milligrams a day of carnosine can protect against copper toxicity in the brain to some extent. Do you know about that research?
No, I really don't. And my message is really a simple one, and that is, if we're focusing our diet on plant-based foods, you're going to do fine. There is copper in these foods, but when studies look at vegetarians, they track the copper in their diet. There's plenty of copper in these foods, but then they track how much copper is in their bloodstream. And you can do the same thing with iron. There's plenty of iron in green leafy vegetables and beans, but then you track how much iron is in the bloodstream. The people who are on plant-based diets seem to do much, much better. They have no more likelihood of running low, and they have a layer of protection with regard to running high. They're less likely to run high. And the way I view it is that our bodies really were designed for plant foods. So if we're low in iron, our body absorbs more iron from these foods. If we're high, our body absorbs less. In the same way as with your breathing, you don't think about it, but if you're a little low in oxygen, you breathe a little bit faster. If you've already got plenty of oxygen, you breathe a little bit slower. It happens unconsciously. But that's the homeostatic mechanisms that we have for these things. But you can defy them. You can defy these mechanisms by having foods that are just packed with iron and packed with copper. I'm speaking of the meats and the liver and the shellfish and that kind of thing.
Well, as you describe, and I know this is true, the damage that eating so much meat and dairy products and certain kinds of fish has done to us, and I know that's true, and I'm imagining many people hearing the kinds of things you're saying might be thinking, well, a healthier diet would have been really good for me, and I see the point, but it's too late now. The damage is done. In your book, you cite the example of Dr. Benjamin Spock, who was, of course, at one time the world's best-known pediatrician, and whose book, Baby and Child Care, I think today still remains one of the best-selling books of all time. I knew him and admired him very much. What took place in his later life that is so remarkable?
Yes, what an amazing man he was. And after he had written Baby and Child Care and he had really advocated for children in so many ways, he started to really lapse into ill health. He had accumulated a lot of fluid in his lungs, and he was coughing and hacking and feeling really terrible. He was developing weakness in his legs and really sort of falling apart. And his wife, Mary Morgan, said, let's really look into nutrition. And up until that point, he had basically said, you know, kids need meat, they need dairy products, they need vegetables, they need grains, you know, a fairly mundane view of nutrition. He went to see somebody who, as fate would have it, was, I think, sort of a macrobiotic practitioner, and told him to get away from the meats and the dairy products and so forth. He gave it a try, and he started to lose this fluid just very rapidly, and his energy came back very, very quickly. And it was astounding to him, and his own physicians had not been able to really help him, but the nutritional change made him just rebound. And I met him around this time, and he became a good friend of ours, and he was an outspoken opponent of the dairy industry at that point. He rewrote Baby and Child Care. It was the 7th edition. He basically said that children ought to be raised on plant-based diets, and it was a courageous thing for him to do, and he lived many, many more years. I think he lived to be about 95, if I'm recalling correctly, and when he finally died, he was as sharp as the day is long. And that's the way we want to be. You're not going to live forever, but as long as you're alive, you want to be energetic. You want to be thoughtful. You want to know who your kids and your grandkids are. You want to be able to enjoy reading and enjoy a walk. And so as long as we're alive, we want to have a healthy mind as well as a healthy body. And that's what Ben did.
His example is extraordinary. I knew him well into his 90s. And I remember him not only for his vast knowledge, which was impressive, but even in his 90s, his curiosity sparkled, his sense of adventure. He was so alive, and his thinking was entirely cogent and lucid.
Yeah.
And I had the counterexample of my own mother, who developed Alzheimer's in her 80s and couldn't remember a thing, and eventually couldn't even remember who I was or who her children were or much of anything, really. And I'm seeing the difference that a life lived by healthy principles and a healthy diet and a constant learning and openness to new experience, it leads to one outcome in the brain, and the typical American life leads to the typical American diseases and the typical American deaths. It just seems to me that so much is at stake here, that people early in their lives, even in their 40s or 30s, are actually setting the stage by how they're living and what they're eating for the type of aging they're going to experience later.
That's true. But the example also shows the resilience of the body. There are cases, like Ben, where he was really going down the wrong road, and he was paying a price for it, and thank heaven for Mary, who grabbed him and said, you're going to eat differently, and of course she joined him with that, and his life turned around dramatically. He would have been dead, and he was completely falling apart. And this is what we saw with Dean Ornish's wonderful work, where he looked at people who had severe heart disease. They change their diet. They throw out the meat, the dairy products, and so forth. They get exercising. They throw away the cigarettes. Their arteries open up again. Now, you don't want to play that game. You don't want to go down the road of ill health and then hope that you can reverse it when you're 80. But the body does have some resilience. And there are people who reverse these things. We've seen it in our diabetes studies. And I am convinced that whatever age you are, if we start on a path of healthier eating, you can be in the best health you could ever be in. But best of all, let's start that for ourselves when we're young. Let's start that for our children right from the beginning. And I really think that we can completely revolutionize the health of this planet if we take advantage of what we now know about foods.
Sometimes the resistance that people experience to this is, it comes from the very widespread belief in our culture that eating healthy foods is a kind of deprivation. Pepsi-Cola has ads right now that reflect this dichotomy. They divide foods into two categories, fun for you and good for you. And their fun for you foods include Doritos and Mountain Dew and Pepsi. In other words, fun for you equals bad for you. But I don't know how much fun it is to have Alzheimer's disease. And it seems to me to be a lot more fun to eat well and think clearly.
Yes, and your tastes change. I have an article that the AMA very kindly just published in its online journal, in which I tell the I tell my own story. When I was beginning my clinical years in medical school, I used to walk in the hospital, and I'd buy a pack of Merit menthols because I was a smoker. And joining me in the hospital gift shop where we sold cigarettes was the head of surgery, and he was buying Marlboros. And we weren't idiots. We just knew that cancer was a slow process, and if eventually we would quit, we'd be okay. And we, frankly, weren't all okay. One of the surgeons did die of lung cancer, but I quit. And at the time, you know, I really liked cigarettes. But you know what? Once you sort of forget about it, you couldn't pay me to go back. Now, it was a little bit later that I decided that the animal products weren't good, and I got rid of them. And there was a period of a week or two of thinking, gee, you know, meat would be nice. But now I've completely lost interest in it. And the foods that I eat now, and frankly the foods that I've got in my new book, Power Foods for the Brain, they're delicious. I wouldn't, to tell me, don't you miss a pork chop or sausage? Those foods to me are so pedestrian, I have completely lost interest in those. And I know that you've seen this, obviously. Both of you have revolutionized what people eat, and you just don't want to go back to the way you ate before.
No, and more and more people, and I'm very grateful for this reality in our times, are waking up to the enhanced aliveness, the greater capacity for pleasure, the joy and vibrancy and vitality that they can experience when they make healthy choices. And it may start out as a bit of a deprivation, but very soon it's enlarging and it adds to your joy, a deep sense of gratitude in life. Neil, I want to thank you because your work for many, many years now and in many forms that it's taken has made such a contribution to this reality, this awakening in our times, and this recommitment to a healthy way of life for all. I salute you. I really do. I celebrate and honor what you've done and what you're doing, and I know what you will do, and I really thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I know all of our listeners do as well.
Well, thank you, John, and right back at you, I got to say, you've been really encouraging people to open their eyes and look around and see how foods affect their health, the world they live in, their families, and I'm proud to have had a chance to learn from you over the years, and we've got a long way to go, but so many people are now embracing this message and spreading it to others, and it's great to see that process unfold.
It is indeed. We've been talking with Dr. Neil Barnard, the author of Power Foods for the Brain and the founder of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Neil, you've done so much research and study on some of the most important health issues of our times, but just as remarkable to me is how digestible you make all this information. You are offering an incredibly useful voice of wisdom and sanity for our times, and we want to thank you for sharing your message with our world, and of course today for sharing it with all of our listeners.
Well, thank you. It's been great to have a chance to catch up a little bit.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want access to 23 more amazing interviews, then we have an offer to share. We'd like to invite you to get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, all 12 hours of interviews, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. You can get this entire package and own it for the rest of your life for very special offers between now and the end of the summit. If you want more information, please go to foodrevolution.org/empowerment. That's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you again for joining us. Have a blessed and beautiful day.
And now we bring you a special bonus recorded message. Over the years, my dad and I have had the privilege of hearing from many thousands of people whose lives have been touched by the food revolution. Some of these people have lost extra weight or gained more energy. Others of them have reversed or even cured life-threatening illnesses such as cancer, heart disease, or diabetes. Some of the stories of transformation are so moving that it seems like they just have to be shared. One of those stories comes from Linda Watkins. I caught up with Linda a few days ago, and this is what she wanted to share with you.
Hi, my name is Linda. I'm 59 years old, and this is my food revolution story. When I was 17, I had open-heart surgery to correct a birth defect. Since then, I have been regularly monitored as a cardiac patient. Antibiotic treatment was required prior to any dental work or surgery. Over the years, I have been diagnosed with scarlet fever, rheumatic fever, congestive heart failure, atrial flutter, mitral valve prolapse, tricuspid valve prolapse, and pulmonary hypertension. I had tried to help my heart disease with a low-carb diet, which was popular at the time, but that only gave me new complications. Then about a year and a half ago, my husband had watched Dr. Neil Barnard's 21-day Kickstart presentation on PBS. And he mentioned that he would like us to try it. He then briefly explained the program to me, and I immediately objected. What are we going to eat? We can't just eat plants. After viewing the show, though, I decided to give it a try for 21 days. Our kitchen was cleared out of animal products in short order. After the first full week, I was actually surprised at how much better I felt. I really had more energy. The transition away from animal products was easier than expected, and we've continued eating this way ever since. While I was by no means sedentary, I started to increase my activity level, especially walking. A few months later, in March 2012, it was time for my annual visit to the cardiologist, which included current blood work. After explaining our change to a plant-based diet, he approved, but said he wanted to monitor me on it. My cholesterol has always been within normal ranges, but it had now gone down a few points lower. It was very noteworthy that the year before, at my 2011 visit, the cardiologist had diagnosed me with atrial flutter. He now stated that he didn't hear anything to be concerned about, saying everything sounded good. The atrial flutter was gone. Next year's annual checkup was then scheduled. I just went to that visit in March 2013, and again he found no problems, not even any leakage from the valves. He said to me that he would still like to check me one more time in 2014. And then he said, "But it looks like you have cured your heart disease." I looked at him and I said, "Don't you mean controlled my heart disease?" He smiled and said, "No, I said cured. I wish more people would do what you have done for yourself with diet and exercise." I was astonished. These were words I had never, ever expected to hear. I am continually discovering delicious new plant-based recipes from cookbooks and other sources, much to my husband's delight. How could I ever have said, "What are we going to eat?" The possibilities are endless, not to mention the benefits.
This segment is now complete. Our next interview will start at the top of the hour. Teleconference and Skype callers can stay on the line or hang up and call back then. If you're listening on the internet, please go to foodrevolution.org/calendar and click on the name of our next speaker to find the player controls. This interview will be available on a replay starting on the hour for the next 23 hours. Or you can get it in CD or digital form, along with transcripts, at foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us.